I would like to thank Dave Weir for recommending this very, very recent story. This very tragic story that has emerged from Northern California. And I also must warn you that this episode contains some details involving child abuse and the deaths of multiple young children that may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. On November 25, 2014, 12-year-old Devante Hart was in attendance at a demonstration in the city of Portland, Oregon. The demonstration was brought about by and intended to bring attention to an incident involving the August 9, 2014 shooting death of Michael Brown, an unarmed African-American man, by Darren Wilson, a white police officer, in the city of Ferguson, Missouri. The death of Michael Brown sparked three waves of civil unrest, not only in Ferguson, but in cities across the United States. The first wave, caused by the shooting itself, lasted from August 9th through August 25th, 2014. The second wave, caused by the announcement that Darren Wilson would not be indicted on any charges resulting from his shooting and killing of Michael Brown, lasted from November 24th through December 2nd, 2014. And the third wave, caused by the first anniversary of the death of Michael Brown, lasted 2 days from August 9th through 11th, 2015. Devante was there participating in the second wave of what has become known as the Ferguson Unrest. The Ferguson Unrest has been associated with being a scene of chaotic rioting, with protesters vandalizing, looting, setting arson fires, and firing weapons. Full disclosure, I was working a lot at the time, and I wasn't watching much of the news because, honestly, the police-involved shootings of young, unarmed African Americans in our country was too much to bear. Following that with the news coverage of the rioting, I just couldn't watch it. I felt like the news was super focused on the violence. And if they had stories like Devante's, they were just going to be fluff pieces or get lost in the shuffle. But his story actually didn't. Not for me, not for many of us. His went viral. Devante wasn't there looting or rioting. He was at the Portland, Oregon protest, holding a sign that said "Free Hugs." And then three worlds collided in one moment that captured something iconic, something beautiful, something that would become seared into our consciousness. I saw it. It came through my news feed. And many of you saw it too. And if you need a refresher, or perhaps you missed it, I will share an image, the image that went viral. The picture that was snapped that day, that for many became a symbol of the change that Americans were out there protesting for. Better relations between law enforcement and the African American community. I am not going to get into what should or shouldn't be done when it comes to affecting change. That's not what this story is about. Portland Police Sergeant Brett Barnum, who had been with the department since 1993, was on duty at the demonstration that day. He spotted Devante holding his "Free Hug" sign, and he thought that was like a really awesome idea. He motioned to Devante to come over his way. Sergeant Barnum wanted to talk to him. As Devante drew closer, the sergeant noticed that the boy had tears streaming down his cheeks. He extended his hand and Devante shook it. He asked Devante why he was crying. Devante said it was because he was sad about all of the protesting and all of the events that were taking place around the country. Sergeant Barnum came to realize that all of this protesting was a lot for a child to try and process, and he wanted to, in some small way, help Devante get back to just being a kid. To not have to shed these tears over this. Children have the right to grow up in a world where they shouldn't have to break down into tears over these sorts of things. Sergeant Barnum acknowledged Devante's feelings. He told him that he understood. But he wanted to try to comfort him, to reassure him that everything was going to be okay. The sergeant told him that he was sorry that this was making him so sad, as at the moment, that was all he really could do. Just apologize that this was the current state of affairs. Sergeant Barnum and Devante talked a little bit more. And soon, he could see Devante's tears had slowed. And it wouldn't be long before they would evaporate from his cheeks. The sergeant saw that the march was about to commence. And he didn't want the 12-year-old to get left behind from the group that he attended the demonstration with. So he told Devante that he'd better get back to his group. But before doing so, Sergeant Barnum looked down at Devante's free hug sign, pointed at it, and said, "Can I have one of those?" And in that same instant, freelance photographer Johnny Nguyen took notice of the conversation between Sergeant Barnum and Devante. As a photojournalist by trade, he most likely had an eye for potential moments such as this. And just as a free hug had been requested from Devante, and Devante accepted, Johnny snapped that moment that the free hug took place. And the next day, the photo of Sergeant Barnum and Devante, fedora on his head, tears streaming down from his eyes, went viral. The sergeant was blown away by the response that the photo had received. For him, as long as it sent the kind of positive message that needed to be sent at a very volatile time, then that's all he needed. He was proud of his city and his department. And that picture was a small example of what that represented for him. Devante was the epitome of what makes public service worthwhile. Devante Hart would die in a horrific automobile crash off of a California cliffside in Mendocino County on March 26, 2018, along with seven other family members. Adoptive mothers Jennifer and Sarah Hart, both 38 years old, adopted children 19-year-old Marquise, and 14-year-olds Jeremiah and Abigail, all three biological siblings, and 16-year-old Hannah, 15-year-old Devante, and 12-year-old Sierra, also biological siblings. But before we get into how they all died, let's first talk about how this family came together and the events leading up to this tragedy. By September of 2006, Jennifer and Sarah Hart were a couple residing in the state of Minnesota. They adopted Marquise, Abigail, and Hannah from Colorado County, Texas, but it isn't certain if both women adopted the children. By September of 2008 is when the first inkling that the family had troubles arose. School officials contacted the Alexandria, Minnesota Police Department regarding a 6-year-old student who had a bruise on the left arm. The name and the gender of the child was redacted. And when questioned by the school staff as to what happened, the child stated that the mother, Jennifer Hart, hit the child on the arm with a belt. Social services was contacted, and along with the police, they interviewed both of the child's parents. And according to the report taken in regards to this case, it said, quote, "The child has been constantly going through food issues where the child will steal people's food at school or eat out of garbage cans or off the floor. The parents deny knowing how the child's arm became bruised, but did indicate that the child recently suffered a fall down a set of stairs located in the house a few days prior to the interview. The report concluded that from a legal standpoint, this case was closed. And in February of 2009, the Harts adopted three more siblings, Hannah, Devante, and Sierra, from Harris County, Texas. Sometime in the later part of 2010, still in the state of Minnesota, another one of the Hart children indicated to a teacher that there was some pain in her stomach and on her back. The school nurse discovered bruises on both of those parts of the child's body. Social services were contacted again, and a visit along with police took place. Sarah Hart admitted to spanking the child while the child was leaning over the edge of the bathtub as punishment for the child's bad behavior. But this time, Sarah Hunt was charged with the malicious punishment of a child and misdemeanor domestic assault. 1 week later, all six Hart children were pulled from public schools to instead be homeschooled. The children would never return to public school again. And according to court documents in April of 2011, Sarah Hunt pleaded guilty to misdemeanor domestic assault involving a child, and the other, more serious charge, malicious punishment of a child, was dismissed. She was sentenced to community service and a year of probation. It is unclear when the Harts and their six children moved to Oregon, but in July of 2013, there was a call made to authorities regarding the family, and police responded to their home. Police would describe this particular incident as a State Department of Human Services referral. Other than that, there are no further details. And then, the iconic picture of Devante was taken in Portland in November of 2014. And it was sometime in mid-2017 that they moved into the house in the city of Woodland, Washington, according to a neighbor named Bruce DeCobb. He described the family as extremely private, but Mr. DeCobb and his wife would describe a disturbing incident that occurred once. At 1:30 in the morning, on a date that he couldn't specifically recall, one of the Hart girls knocked on his door. He answered it, and she told him that she needed help, that her parents were mistreating her, and she needed them to protect her. He ended up taking the child back to her parents that night, and he did go over there the next morning to check up on the girl, and to him, at the time, everything seemed okay, and he decided to let the incident go. In November of 2017, a couple of months after the family moved to Woodland, the father of a woman who lived next door to the Harts called 911 with a very disturbing report. He told dispatch that there had been some kids next door whom he feels are being abused, that something very serious was going on with these children in that home, explaining that not too long ago, a little girl jumped out of the second story window on the roof and then jumped down to the ground at 2 in the morning. And this girl ran to his daughter's home, begging her for help. She also begged them to not tell her parents that she went over there. But her parents were contacted nonetheless, and one of the mothers came over and collected the child. Later on the next day, one of the parents had four of the children come back over to the neighbor's house and explain that everything was okay. But to them, there was something strange about their behavior. They were standing there at attention, and they looked scared to death. It is unclear whether authorities ever took any action or not. Then sometime in March of 2018, Devante began going over to Mr. DeCobb's house asking for food. He told him that his parents regularly took meals away from him and his siblings as a form of punishment. According to Mr. DeCobb, Devante would come over to his house once a day. But soon, he was coming over more frequently, pretty much 3 times a day as the boy was showing up asking for more food. It was at that point that DeCobbs made the decision to contact authorities, as this was obviously very concerning to them. On March 23, 2018, Mr. DeCobbs contacted Child Protective Services and reported what had been going on with the children living next door, that he is concerned that there may be a case of child neglect as they don't seem to be given regular meals. The Washington State Department of Social and Health Services opened a Child Protective Services investigation, which stated that the Hart children had been identified as potential victims of alleged abuse or neglect. Jennifer Hart arrived home from work that same afternoon. And officials knocked on the door, but she did not answer. She knew that this was over. The entire facade of this seemingly happy family of 6 adopted children was about to come crashing down. And she made the decision that she was not going to wait around for authorities to come knocking again. On March 24, 2018, Jennifer and Sarah Hart packed their 6 children into the family's 2003 GMC Yukon XL and began heading south. The family is known to have been in the Newport, Oregon area around 8:15 that morning. They continued traveling south along U.S. Route 101 until they arrived in Leggett, California. They then transitioned on the California State Route 1 until they arrived in Fort Bragg at approximately 8 p.m. The family stayed in Fort Bragg for approximately 24 hours. The following day, March 25th, Jennifer Hart was captured on surveillance footage making a purchase at a Safeway in Fort Bragg. The family seemed to have stayed in and around the Fort Bragg area until approximately 9 p.m. that evening. The specific movements of the family from that point on are unknown. On March 26th, Cowlitz County Child Protective Services conducted a welfare check at the Hart home, but no one came to the door. They weren't there, and they were never going to be there. It would be on that same day that the Hart family SUV was spotted upside down along a jagged shoreline at the bottom of a 100-foot cliff along a remote stretch of highway in Mendocino County, California, located approximately 180 miles or 290 kilometers north of San Francisco. A passerby noticed the overturned and crashed SUV and reported it to authorities. When authorities arrived at the scene, what they found was carnage. Jennifer and Sarah Hart were inside the vehicle, dead. 3 of the children, Marquise, Jeremiah, and Abigail, were found outside the vehicle, also dead. The car, it seemed, traveled about 75 to 100 feet along a dirt turnout next to the highway prior to plunging over the edge of the cliff. There was no indication that the vehicle had skidded or that the brakes were applied in any way, and it appeared to have been down there for several hours before being discovered. By March 27th, authorities got word that the women actually had 6 children and 3 remained unaccounted for: Hannah, Devante, and Sierra. A search and rescue effort was launched in and around the waters where the vehicle went off the cliff. The California Highway Patrol launched a fixed winged airplane and a helicopter to aid in the search from the air. The United States Coast Guard was called in to bring a rescue boat to also aid in the effort from the water. In the meantime, Child Protective Services attempted another welfare check on the 27th of March, but again found nobody at home. And from what could be seen, their absence did not appear to be something that was going to be long-term. They also found pets inside the home. At this point, they were unaware that the family had gone over that cliffside in California. By the 28th, it seemed that the Mendocino County Sheriff was uncertain as to what to make of the accident. He reported that it looked as though all six children were inside the vehicle when it went over the cliff, but it was possible that they were left in the care of someone else and were still looking for those possibilities. The sheriff also reported at the time that he did not have any evidence or reason to suspect that this was an intentional act on the part of the driver of the vehicle, still considering the possibility that this event was an accident. On March 29th, a search warrant was issued and executed at the Hart family home. In the affidavit requesting the search warrant, it indicated that they were seeking evidence as to what may have happened to the family, including the possibility of a suicide note. Authorities seized a laptop and an iPad. The California Highway Patrol, however, quickly came to believe that a felony had been committed in relation to this crash. And 2 days later, on April 1st, authorities publicly announced that they believed the crash to be intentional. Investigators were able to retrieve data from the vehicle's airbag module and the vehicle software. It showed that the SUV came to a stop at the turnout and then accelerated full speed towards the cliff and plunged off. Meanwhile, the search for Devante, Hannah, and Sierra continued. On April 4th, a large-scale search and rescue operation was initiated, with approximately 80 people on foot searching the rocky areas surrounding the location of the crash. It was also on this day that authorities reported to the media that it was Jennifer Hart who was driving the vehicle when it went over the edge of the cliff. The Mendocino County Sheriff also shifted his original opinion of this being an accident to believing it to have been an intentional act, a crime. The next day, on April 5th, the sheriff reported to the media that neither Jennifer or Sarah had seatbelts on, which was contrary to some earlier reports that the women were seatbelted in. Also on April 5th, the search for Hannah, Devante, and Sierra was forced to be suspended due to a forecast calling for heavy rains over the next several days. They also confirmed that it is their strong belief that the three children were in fact in the vehicle at the time of the crash, stating in a press release, quote, "Information obtained through interviews with family and friends indicated that it was rare for the family to be apart, especially when traveling." That information, coupled with the other children being recovered outside the vehicle, supports the possibility that the missing children were swept away from the crash scene by the Pacific Ocean. And then on April 7th, 2 weeks after the fatal crash, a child's body was discovered in the surf near the site where the SUV plunged over that cliff. DNA results confirmed what investigators already suspected, that these were the remains of one of the missing three Hart children. It was 12-year-old Sierra, 16-year-old Hannah, and 15-year-old Devante are still missing to this day and are presumed dead. On April 14th, authorities reported that Jennifer Hart, the one who was driving the vehicle when it went off the cliff, was found to have a blood alcohol content at 0.1%, just over the legal limit of 0.08% in California. The others in the vehicle, her wife Sarah, and two of the three children who were discovered deceased at the scene, were found to have the active ingredient of Benadryl in their systems, according to the toxicology report, which is an antihistamine that causes drowsiness. So, dreamers, I really don't have the desire to sit here and point fingers as to why all of this was allowed to happen. I usually do, but this particular story is so frustratingly tragic. I don't even really want to think about the what ifs. It's too heartbreaking. But we can talk a little bit about the how. It seemed to be a combination of two things: isolation and a social media facade. Remember I mentioned earlier, after Sarah Hart was arrested on those abuse charges in 2010, all six children were pulled from public school under the guise of being homeschooled. Cases like this paint an unfortunate picture of homeschooling children, which I don't want to do. However, when there seems to be other things swirling around the family, like teachers reporting suspected abuse, things like that, the fact that they were pulled in favor of homeschool only compounds any suspicion abuse might be taking place. Homeschooling independent of all these other reported incidents is by no means a clear indicator that something untoward is going on inside the home. But in this specific case, it's pretty obvious that the guise of homeschooling the six Hart children was an attempt to avoid any further mandated reporting of suspected abuse by any more public school teachers or administrators. And that should have been a red flag, particularly because of the timing, along with the criminal charges having been levied against one of the parents. But I will say this. It is not clear if both women adopted the children or if it was only Jennifer. It's been made clear through various reports that Jennifer Hart was the head of the household, and her wife Sarah held a secondary position as an authority figure in the home. Jennifer was the one who drove the car off the cliff. Maybe she compelled Sarah to take the fall for the abuse charges, especially if Sarah wasn't named as one of the adoptive parents. But it could very well have been both of them abusing the children. I don't know. All we know is who committed the worst and final act. So this isolation, particularly from mandated reporters like teachers and doctors, is one indicator that the children may be in an abusive situation. Then there were the frequent moves. Not small moves either, but from state to state. Whenever new suspicions arose, whenever Child Protective Services were contacted, the family would pick up and move again. And this is considered an extreme measure when it comes to keeping their children out of the view of the public and from prying eyes. And it's not always obvious injuries. When children are sent to school, teachers will notice small things, innocuous things that seem inconspicuous. Things like, have they been wearing the same clothes all week? Or are they always hungry when they get to school? Public schools have to report suspicions. And neighbors, they aren't mandated, but they notice these things too. The Hart children regularly reached out to neighbors for help. And in this case, neighbors did contact Child Protective Services, leading to the family being uprooted and moved out of state. But this last time, Jennifer Hart decided that when Mr. DeKalb called, it would be the final time. This, coupled with the food, specifically the withholding of food, which is something that was apparent to several people over a number of years, all of these things, even independent of each other, can be concerning. But all occurring within the confines of the same family, alarm bells should have been going off. Which it seems that they were. But help just didn't come in time. Now, if you didn't know how the story of the Hart family came to its tragic conclusion, you would never know what was going on behind the idyllic photos that the family posted across their social media platforms. They appeared to be like this superb example of the modern family. Two white moms adopting six African American children. There's picture after picture after picture of all of them, flanking their mothers, broad smiles, cute poses, matching clothing, holding up peace signs, chalkboard messages with things like, "There will always be love." Or the eight of them standing before beautiful outdoor backdrops. The six children standing in rows. Devante, at that Ferguson protest, holding that chalkboard sign that said, "Free hugs, pass it on." They seemed active. The children were engaged. They were going to special events. They were doing things. They were having fun. They were always in the outdoors. They go hiking, swimming, gardening, stargazing. If you were to only look at Jennifer Hart's Facebook page, life could not be better for this family. Playing at the park, playing with each other, cooking meals, enjoying life. All of the things a family should be. Happy, fun, loving, active, healthy. And this is mostly what people who knew the family thought of them. Despite all of the warnings, the reports to Child Protective Services, the reports that the children's schools made, the frequent moves, the begging for help from neighbors, Jennifer and Sarah Hart were able to sidestep all of it and sell the image of the family that they wanted everyone to buy. And the darker, more troubled portrait of the Hart family did not fully emerge until it was too late. So, dreamers, I began to wonder about that picture of Devante with that police officer. The one of him with the tears streaming down his cheeks embracing that officer. How symbolic that photo became during the Ferguson protests. I told you Sergeant Bonham's take on the moment. To him, as he told it, it felt genuine. I think we would be hard-pressed to not find ourselves moved by a young boy shedding tears over the traumatic events happening around him. But what traumatic events was he really crying over? He told Sergeant Barnum that he was sad about the state of the world. But now that we know what was going on behind closed doors in this boy's life, do those tears take on a different meaning? I tend to think so. And there are two possible theories out there. One is mine, and the other comes from an article I read. It is strongly opinionated in terms of the motivation of Devante approaching Sergeant Barnum. But I will tell you mine first because it's pretty simple. I think Devante's abundance of tears were for all of the things that he had wished he would have been able to say to Sergeant Barnum in that moment, but he couldn't because his mothers were there looking on. I can't help but wonder, as he took each step towards the police officer, that he wanted so much for everything to come spilling out of him. All of the hurt, the pain, the anguish, the torment, the suffering, the isolation, the loneliness, the abuse, the manipulation, the exploitation, the starvation, the deprivation, the fear. But he couldn't. All he could do was cry. And if you have seen this picture, there are a lot of tears on Devante's face. Every one of those tears represented everything Devante could not speak out loud. And maybe he was hoping Sergeant Barnum would pick up on it. But Devante stuck to his script and just explained that he was sad about the state of things between officers and the African American community. he gave Sergeant Barnum his free hug and made his way back over to his family. I read this other article, and it had a bit more of an aggressive tone about the whole encounter between Devante and Sergeant Barnum. But I will try to get to the core of what the point of the article is the best I can. The photograph of Devante hugging a police officer, tears running down his cheeks, emerged during a time when racial tensions were on the rise between the African American community and law enforcement. This image was taken completely out of context and used as some sort of symbol of hope that relationships could be mended, that there was hope for peacefulness between African Americans and police officers, and racial tensions in America in general. Many saw the photo as nothing more than propaganda, especially when it came out later that the boy was shown in images earlier that he was already distraught, that there was a strong indication that he was forced to come forward to have that exchange with Sergeant Barnum. But dreamers, remember Sergeant Barnum is the one who spotted the free hug sign and motioned for Devante to come forward, that he saw him crying and wanted to inquire as to what was wrong. And all he could really think to do was reassure Devante, apologize, and collect on one of those free hugs. For him, the moment was genuine. But what about Devante? According to the article that I read, it was apparently revealed later that Devante was in fact terrified and had to be coerced into going over to having that exchange with Sergeant Bonham. And that according to a post on Jennifer Hart's Facebook regarding the image, that this was her telling of the experience. Quote, "Last night, I encouraged Devante to face his concerns and fears. It was one of the most emotionally charged experiences I've had as a mother. He trembled, holding a free hug sign as he bravely stood alone in front of the police barricade. Tears rushing from his eyes, soaking his sweater, he gazed upon them, not knowing how they would react. After a while, one of the officers approached him and extended his hand. Their interaction was uncomfortable at first. I kept my distance and allowed him space to truly have his own experience." Let me pause here for a moment before I continue with what this article had to say. The description of the moment between Devante and Sergeant Barnum was penned by the same woman who drove him, his 5 siblings, her wife, and herself off of a cliff because Child Protective Services was called to the front door 1 too many times. We know full well by now that social media was an elaborate disguise for what was truly going on in real life. She interpreted Devante's feelings as she wanted the world to see. This was all about her and the image she needed to uphold. If she had to force Devante into shaking hands with Sergeant Barnum, I get that. I can totally see a child being afraid of police, especially with everything that was going on at the time. And I wouldn't be surprised if the moms themselves helped perpetrate and instill the fear of law enforcement onto their children as yet another way of isolating them even further. They aren't going to report the fact that they are being abused at home to people that they fear. And I think it would even be safe to say that those children probably feared their own mothers more than they feared police. So anyway, back to the article. It goes on to say that it was later revealed that the officer hugging Devante is a strong supporter of Darren Wilson, the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown, and described the interaction between Devante and Sergeant Barnum as grotesque, that Devante was there to protest against Darren Wilson and the liberties with which they have to shoot and kill, but yet he was forced to hug someone who supported it. Or, as the article read, quote, "forced to embrace somebody who fully supported the systematic oppression of his own people," unquote. Wasn't Devante holding a free hug sign? He wasn't holding a sign that said, "free hugs, except for white police officers who support the oppression of my people." And Sergeant Barnum certainly didn't get a closer look at Devante and say, "oh, you know what? I'm all about the oppression of your people, so that'll be a hard pass on the free hug." It's just to me, it looked and felt like a really genuine moment. So then the article goes into Jennifer and Sarah Hart's role in the lives of these six children, calling them, quote, white saviors, unquote. I actually really hadn't thought about it while I was researching this story, because it hadn't really quite crossed my mind because I was so focused on the abuse and the deaths. It's my first inclination to kind of agree that that was the narrative the couple were trying to play into. But for some reason, I kind of lean towards there being some sort of positive outcome to the story behind the intention. You know, kind of like the movie The Blind Side, the savior thing gets thrown around a lot. As a wealthy white family takes in an African-American teenager who's been in foster care, having ended up with no real place to live, and then going on to enjoy a career in the NFL. That's the kind of story I think of when I hear the term white savior. However, the picture that Jennifer and Sarah Hart were painting of the family on social media told a very different story of what was going on, and it might be indicative of that specific label. Did these two women have this white savior complex? I don't know. I suppose. But I think it's likely that they would have been abusive to any adopted children, no matter what their race, to be honest. The article ends up criticizing the handling of the child abuse allegations, that things weren't handled well because the children were African American and the moms were white. I'm really not going to get into that today because it's just too contentious. But I did want to revisit the meaning of that picture, and I will post it on social media. And we can talk about what we think all of those tears really represented. Thank you for joining me for this bonus. Thank you again, Dave, for the case suggestion. And until next time, sweet dreams.